This morning we have a very interesting problem, and to approach it we have to go back over a great deal of the world's thinking from comparatively ancient times. The study of the human soul and of the world soul, this study was developed most exhaustively by the Neoplatonists of Alexandria, particularly Plotinus and Proclus. These two great scholars, mystics, and contemplators, deriving their inspirations from Plato and Pythagoras, evolved a concept of personal relationship between man and the universe that had not previously been emphasized. As a result of the fortunate location of the Alexandrian school of Neoplatonism, the founders and developers of this philosophy were able to draw from practically all of the known religions of mankind. And the result was a tremendous advance in philosophical idealism. All of the Platonists and Neoplatonists were idealists. That is, they did not believe or accept a materialistic attitude toward life and living. On the other hand, they were the first to make a clear reconciliation between scientific progress and mystical insight. They did not bring these two into conflict, but kept them in a completely complementary relationship. They found no reason to deny that which science advances, but no reason to accept scientific opinion which is not within the scientific sphere. In other words, science has its own world. Its world is essentially the exploration of the material structure of things. This exploration has advanced knowledge and inspired idealism in many instances. But the idealist does not accept the scientific position that science has disproved the mystical and metaphysical traditions of antiquity. It has not the equipment, nor the interest, nor the background to pass judgment on sacred matters. On the other hand, it is a mistake for religion and mysticism to attempt to dominate the sphere of material science, trying to discredit by theological means the scientific advancements of many very learned specialists. But side by side in Alexandria, these two systems lived together in harmony, and each advanced the contributions of the other. And today we realize that there is no greater potential power for the development of an idealistic philosophy of life than science, if science begins to seek for the realities behind the facts which it has accumulated. So on this basis, the Neoplatonists and other Greek and later other Oriental systems began to study the mystery of what we call the human soul. It was obvious to the wise of all ages that man was not merely a body. It was also inconceivable to thoughtful persons that the creating process should produce a form of life such as humanity and lock that form into a mortal existence of 80 years and then dissipate all that the individual has learned during that period of time. There would be no development for the individual under the materialistic concept of life. And it became essential to recognizing the actual integrity of a divine principle in order to develop slowly a system of thought which preserved the integrity of deity and at the same time advanced the materialistic forms of knowledge which were irreconcilable with theology unless reinterpreted. The human soul has been variously defined. Many different sects and creeds have their own approach to this simple but very interesting subject. The general theory is that the soul is a link between the body of man and the divine constitution in which he partakes. Therefore, the Trinity of the ancients was spirit, soul, and body. With spirit as the source of all life, body as a reservoir or container of forms, and these linked together by an energy or a principle which was called the soul. The soul, therefore, was created from the beginning to be a reconciler. Its purpose was to bring together opposites which otherwise could not be easily reconciled. In alchemy, mercury was the symbol of the human soul, or the divine soul. It was the universal agent by means of which salt and sulfur could be reconciled. Sulfur being the symbol of spirit, salt the symbol of body. Mercury was that which could absorb into itself other metals and substances and make an amalgam of them. Thus, it became natural to the alchemy to think of the soul not only as a reconciler of spiritual and material forms, but a reconciler of attitudes, of beliefs, of opinions, of policies. The universal solvent, or the soul, was the reconciler of all things. And wherever conflict arises, the soul must reconcile the conflict. If we permit the conflict itself to endure without being reconciled, we then have individuals, nations, and worlds torn apart. Not because there is a basic error involved, but because there is a secondary error, the error of assuming that things which are different cannot be harmonized. Actually, the whole purpose of human evolution is to reconcile the differences of appearances and to demonstrate the sovereignty of one divine principle. Actually, we understand from Neoplatonism that as a spirit inhabits all things, bestowing upon them the life of existence, that this spirit, which is the universal fire, flame, or power, without which there can be no motion, no emotion, no conscious growth, no means of unfoldment, because actually, all things are the growth within the substance of spirit, and all growth is a means toward the final purposes of the divine spirit. This being according to their ancient thinking, it was necessary for them to reconcile in their thinking and in their living all of the opposites of existence. Realizing that opposites are dangerous because of their mutual conflicts, but that all conflicts and all opposites are reconciled in God. And those who come nearer and nearer to participation in the divine principle find it ever easier to be friendly, to be cooperative, to be kind, to be gentle. Cooperation expresses itself through affection, through relationships. It is everywhere a bringing together for fruitfulness, whether it is in the physical world or in the psychic nature itself. Those things which are harmonized and brought together in friendliness become the basis of new generations of improved psychological and mystical conditions. Now today we have a world that is in a very confused state. And this confusion is, strangely enough, almost completely illusionary. This does not mean that the individual can simply erase it from his own experience. We rather take the attitude that there are things essentially true and things which appear to be true but are not essentially so. This is one of the problems we have in life. Everywhere, there are things that seem irreconcilable. whether they be political, social, economic, religious, or philosophical. But all these can be reconciled because they are essentially vitalized by one power. They are expressions of one energy. This energy being diversified through the bodies of planets, through the structures of society, through the nations of the world, and through the unfoldment of individuals. Yet all life is one. Therefore, the true discovery of the essential of life must bring reconciliation. It is because we have not achieved this that we are in trouble. Now, the question that the Neoplatonists approached rather successfully, and the Buddhists also, was, if there is an essential unity, why is it not obvious to us? Why have we not received the blessing of this realization from the beginning of our existence? For this answer, we have to take a slight detour into science. We have to realize that science has demonstrated certain truths or facts which are useful to us. Science is giving us an ever fuller understanding of the structure of the human mind. The human mind is a very interesting and delicate instrument manifesting through a still more delicate instrument, the brain. Now, the mind of its own nature and of its own kind is essentially a unity-seeking power. But in the development and evolution of human beings, the mind has become the great separator. The mind has been gradually accepted by most persons and by most systems of culture as the infallible estimator of values. What the mind says must be true. What the mind thinks must be defended. And whatever direction the mind turns its attention, it presents an interesting conflict. The human mind is a partly developed function. It is something that is not by any means perfect. And looking out upon the environment, the mind comes to conclusions which are derived from imperfect and immature faculty powers within the mind itself. Therefore, the mind is not infallible. The things we think are not necessarily true. The opinions we develop may be false. And practically all of our relationships with each other are determined by mental attitudes. All likeness and dissimilarity are mental experiences. We like and dislike people, not because we understand them, but because the mind has presented to us an image of them. The mind, because it is incomplete, imperfect, and in a state of evolutionary development, is accepted as a final criterion when it cannot be a criterion to this degree. So as the Hindu tells us in his sacred book, the Gita, the mind is the slayer of the real. The mind is in bondage to the faculties and perceptions which have developed within man. These faculties and perceptions are highly competitive. They represent the unbalanced growths of various powers and perceptive faculties. The individual, as a physical person, is largely dominated by the tyranny of his own thinking. He is dominated by his own conclusions about things he does not understand. He is the subject and victim of hypotheses. He is constantly frustrated by logic, which is estimated as probably the great doctrine of fallacies. And logic itself is the greatest of its own fallacies. The person, consequently, looking out upon life, does not see life as it is. He sees it in terms of his own feelings. If life has hurt him, life looks bad. If life has gratified him, it is better. If those around him agree with him, they are wise. If they disagree with him, they are stupid. And he has carried this into everything. Even broken up groups of solid substances in this kind of pattern. The physician, with the medical training, has his own set of faculties conditioned by his own training. And yet, although he may be trained with many others of his own kind, physicians are not in general agreement. Each one has a major premise which he has interpreted or misinterpreted in terms of his own insight. The same is true of law. The same is true of architecture. A building that pleases one person displeases another. The world of music, although it is one common unit, is divided into innumerable subdivisions, most of which are in competition with each other. So we live in a world which is a unit, indivisible and indissolvable, and we live in it in a state of complete and continuous segmentation. As long as we follow this rule, we have to depend largely upon the mind. And the mind itself, in our particular case today, is getting very weary. The mind is gradually coming to realize that it does not have the answers. And that no matter how cleverly we intellectualize, we may still be wrong. We also know that the mind, because of the ingenuity within it, is continually complicating the dilemma. The mind trying to find ways out of this labyrinth simply creates new blind passageways for itself. It is caught in a web of intellection from which it is almost impossible for it to escape. Now, mind in humanity is divided into many levels. There are many who are more gifted than others, who have greater and better intellectual faculties than others. But this does not solve the situation. The comparatively small mind has small troubles, but does not escape trouble. The great minds have great troubles, which they compound for each other. There seems to be no way out of this net of mental overemphasis or specialization. Considering the facts as they are, then, we know that Buddha developed the concept of the mental coordinator. The mental coordinator had no infallibility, no divine sanction, and was in many cases indefensible. But it was simply what we now know it to be, namely, a common market in which various faculty testimonies are examined and combined and ordered or disordered, as the case may be. The mind simply mingles together the testimonies of the five senses and gives us a verdict. Now, this verdict may or may not be true according to the testimonies of the sensory perceptions. The evaluation of a personal or a collective experience is very difficult. To one person, a certain thing may be a disaster. To another, the beginning of a new and better life. Everything is determined by the ability to integrate the experience factors in human consciousness. So the Neoplatonists developed this simple notion that you might as well get over the idea that the word mind is a synonym of I or me. When you say, I think, you do not really mean I think. You mean, I have given the power of thought to the mind. The mind is thinking, not me. I am behind the mind somewhere, usually lost in the bushes. When we say, I think, therefore, it is a mistake. And when we say, I know, we are in even a greater danger of dilemma. Because in these cases, we have always an identification of self with mind, and they are not the same thing. We also have a very complicated relationship, because the mind becomes the basis of a series of egoistic extensions of activity. I want does not mean that the spirit is in need. It merely means that the mind is avaricious. When we say, I hope, there is a great question as to the consistency of the hope, but we still refer to it always in the terms of I. So we assume that within ourselves is an absolutely correct function process. There is an infallible center, and we call it I, but really it is the mind. And there is really nothing infallible about the intellect. The intellect is an instrument which, properly used, can give us great help and consolation, but misused can bring us constantly into greater difficulties and dangers. So the Neoplatonist attempted to transfer the center of personal allegiance from the mind to the soul. The soul being the part of man which corresponds to the soul in the nature of the divine. The soul is always a savior, a sota. The soul is the beloved son of the spirit. The soul is the mediator between heaven and earth. It is the power to reconcile or bring together or reinterpret in terms of integrities the various conflicts due to intellect. The soul is therefore superior to intellect. Now, in modern times, we've made a very serious mistake. We have developed an art or science which we call psychology, the word simply meaning the language of the soul. But the average psychologist does not even believe in a soul. He is completely linked to the physical sciences. He believes that the brain is the instrument through which a mental focus functions, and that this mental center is the person. He does not understand that the so-called psyche of science is simply another name for Buddha's machine of the six sensory powers. The psychologist does not recognize in most instances that there is something above mind in the structure of the individual or of the world. The Neoplatonists, working with the subject of soul, came to the conclusion that the soul was a kind of entity in itself, that it was something that had a nature of its own, and that just as the body of the individual is derived from the elements of nature, which in turn are derived from the material structure of the divine purpose, so the soul is composed of the elements of a psychic realm, that it is composed of actual materials, soul substances, and that this soul is a body in itself. But instead of being bound to the limitations of matter, because it is more subtle, more highly attenuated, and originates from a higher plane of creation, it has an extension of power, an extension of insight, and an extension of authority far greater than the mind. Therefore, the individual who is wise tries in every way possible to transfer the allegiances which he has given to the mind and bestow them upon the soul, allowing the soul to guide him into the proper use of his own mind or the use of the body. Unless he makes this adjustment, the soul power, as such, is not able to carry forward the great purposes of evolution. Now, in science, evolution is a formal growth, or a development of material forms, and has been traced fairly successfully by the Darwinian theory. But actually, evolution is the gradual victory of soul power over body. Evolution is an ideation. It is an unfoldment from within, by which more and more of the outer life is directed by inner soul power. Now, if there is a soul in man, there's another inevitable conclusion, that this soul originates in the divine soul. No man or human being or any creature can possess an attribute which is not in the nature of the creating power. Nothing can be bestowed by the Creator which the Creator itself or himself does not possess. As the soul function is more and more obvious and has been pretty carefully studied, it becomes obvious that the human soul is descended from and derived from the soul of deity, and that therefore it possesses a considerably greater range of realizations than are found in the mind or in the psychological organism of modern science. In this thought, therefore, we find that all nature, or the universe in all its parts, consists of a creating process, a transformational process, and a gradual process of regeneration or redemption. Things are created, they are sustained, and they are gradually transformed. And in the terms of the psychic nature, the transformation is a growth, an extension of the individual. And all evolution is the release of soul from mind and body. And the more of the soul power that is manifested, the nobler the person will be, the more genuine their integrities will be. And they will begin to release more and more of those primary virtues which we attribute to deity, but the seeds of which are also in ourselves. Now, here we are in a prime muddle at the present time as far as world conditions are concerned. It is obvious that science can't solve the mystery. The scientist can complicate life and, in many senses and ways, can facilitate the physical security of the individual. He can do many things to help him to be more comfortable, more secure in his way of life. And it looked for a long time as though science was the saving power of the universe. But in the midst of all of its benevolent bestowals, it gave us hydrogen bomb. This, in one fell swoop, destroyed the basic confidence of humanity in science. Realizing that something was wrong, little people asked questions. And one of the most common and simple questions is, if the scientist is truly a superior person, why does he not have the insight and wisdom to protect people from his own inventions? If he is truly enlightened, how can he bestow a death-dealing device, the worst known since the beginning of time, upon a comparatively unequipped humanity? So in a very short time, something happened, and people began to ask little questions. One of the questions was, couldn't the scientist, with all his brilliance and all his inventions and all his machinery, foresee what he was doing? Could he not realize that if he continued in the present course, that he would ultimately come upon these deadly devices? The scientist really had no good answer for this, any more than we can answer why it is that the automobile industry is in great difficulty, because it continued for years to make large and difficult cars in the presence of a dwindling fuel supply. Could not these brilliant industrialists realize the facts long before they began to blame other nations for importing small cars. Why didn't they make them themselves? Some strange blind spot. And this blind spot is really the dramatic symbol of exactly what the mind is. One great big blind spot. Surrounded by a radiant fringe of desires and ambitions. This is what we had. So having lost faith, somewhat at least, and more every day, in the omnipotence of science, it became reasonable to realize that there was something lacking in the constitution of man, that in some mysterious way he had been led astray, that it was not the result of eating an apple that gave us this major pandemonium. The real cause of it was the constant compromise of principle for profit. Everywhere, at all times, man would do what the Goethe tells in Faust. He would sell his soul for temporal gain. Now, the soul that he sold, of course, really wasn't for sale. It was something locked within himself. He could not barter it, but he could create a structure of attitudes which would not permit it to develop. He could isolate it and imprison it. And this is very largely what he has done. He has not been able or willing to give it an opportunity to reveal itself. Now, how do we make soul reveal itself? Well, the first thing we have to do is believe in it. And if we doubt that there is such a thing, then we can look back through the great codes of the world, the great codes of morality and ethics, and discover that they are not based upon science. They are not really based upon philosophy, although they may have many philosophical elements. These codes are all based upon a deep human sense of value. These codes are based upon a spiritual approach to existence. They take spiritual power, transmute it into a kind of higher mysticism, and by this they are able to judge the values of material things. So we have evidence of soul everywhere. We have it in the mother's love for a child. We have it in the love of man and woman. We have it in the love of nation or country or race, love of art, love of music, appreciation for beauty. Plotinus, in his great essay on the beautiful, tells us that we call a thing beautiful because it is appealing and pleasing to a beauty in ourselves. If the beauty was not in us, we would never see it anywhere else. In the same way with architecture. Many buildings are built by persons who obviously have no concept of beauty and are perfectly willing to compromise beauty for economy, cost less, or for efficiency, which may or may not cost less. But the point is that the true architect fulfills a beauty within himself. The true author writes a beauty from within his own heart and mind. But if the mind runs the heart and the mind runs the soul, he's going to write for profit. Because he is not going to be aware. And he is going to place immediate advantage to himself above the common good of humanity. We have this completely through the television industry, through practically all of the entertainment field, and in most forms of business. Business is all pointed to profit by appealing to that part of man which is not soul, and allowing the soul factor to die of starvation. It won't die, but it's slow in coming around, and it will only be when man is weary of his mistakes that he is really going to get hold of his own resources. There is so much more in the human being than has ever come out of him that there is great cause for ultimate optimism that the thing will work out in the end. Now, in looking around us in life, we become aware that the confusion of the individual is based upon a collective confusion, or that one way or another the two are related. Some would probably say with considerable integrity that the world confusion is primarily the result of the confusion in the human being. But whichever way we care to view it, the fact remains that we are in one of the most troubled periods in the history of our civilization. A troubled period in which we are desperately seeking some kind of a solution. We have reached a point in mental isolation in which it is almost impossible to convert an individual to anything he does not want to believe. He cannot be converted. He cannot be legislated. If government tries to impose virtue upon the individual, there will be revolution. If the individual attempts to impose virtue upon government, he becomes himself in grave danger. The whole situation is locked on a level, and the level is simply too low to provide survival. It has to be changed. How are we going to accomplish this change? Nature probably will have to do it. What we try to do ourselves is now too mixed up with our own mistakes. We bring young people into the world, we misinform them, miseducate them, dedicate them to goals which are not real, and then as a kind of penance fee at the end, we give them a pension. But the entire structure is wrong. The purpose of education from educo is to draw forth from the person that which is within himself, that is his soul power. Instead of that, we cram into his brain and mind all forms of conflicting and indigestible elements and expect him to become an enlightened citizen. It's just not possible. He turns to religion for help, and he comes upon a battle of creeds. And he finds that too much religion now is very overconscious of financial improvement. Also, we turn to industry to find it completely perverted so that the only consideration is profit. So the young person today is taught how to make a living, but never how to build a life. He is taught what he has to do, the compromises he has to make in order to be successful in a civilization in which true success, in its better sense of the word, is practically impossible. To meet this, we cannot expect the government or any of this type of thing to take the lead. The improvement of each individual is his own private job, and he must finally come to this realization. Any person who so desires can gradually, through a process of quiet information and meditation, contemplation of values, and reference to the enlightened scriptural and sacred writings of the world, he can come to a reasonable conclusion concerning what constitutes integrity. He can begin to realize that this little voice of conscience that's within himself may very well be the voice of his own soul. And that this voice continually blames him when he's wrong and impels him to be right. By gradually developing the internal resources of ourselves, we can gain values that will enable us to achieve a victory over circumstances. This victory is a private victory. And for the most part, we can achieve it with practically no opposition from other people. Some sacrifice, yes, because if we are trying to be right, we cannot share in the spoilage of that which is wrong. But for the most part, we can quietly adapt our own hearts and minds to the realities of life. Instead of sitting back in a state of abject terror at the changes and vicissitudes and dangers of the day, we can begin to have the achievement of following the example in the gospel where Jesus walks upon the waters and told the storms to be silent and still, and they were. The individual can learn to live in this world constructively and creatively and morally if he so desires. And it is only through the gradual development of these qualities and characteristics that he can ultimately become a self-protecting, self-leading being. It is the only way he is going to overcome the ills of his own mind and gradually make the mind an instrument of value for the development of soul power. The mind turned downward develops physical conspiracies. The mind turned upward to the soul becomes the priest in the temple of enlightenment. It has to be worked out through our own dedications to the values that are necessary to protect life. Now, on the general collective field of things out in the large world, we have nothing but an infinite number of repetitions of exactly the same structure that we have within man himself. The world's soul is the unity. It is the...